coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. Former Federal Bureau of Investigation Deputy Director Andrew McCabe has been fired. President Trump applauded McCabe's firing on Twitter. He has been criticizing the FBI for alleged political bias. And McCabe was thrust into controversy just days before the 2016 presidential election when it was disclosed that his wife, a political candidate, took campaign donations from a political action committee controlled by a friend of Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. In response to Britain's decision to expel 23 Russian diplomats, Russia is now following suit by expelling 23 British diplomats. Britain made the move in response to the poisoning of former spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, who were found unconscious on a park bench in the English town of Salisbury.
The British government has firmly pointed the finger of blame at Russian President Vladimir Putin. Moscow denies any involvement, but has refused to explain how former spy Skripal and his daughter Yulia could have been exposed to a chemical weapon in the UK that British authorities contend was developed in the former Soviet Union. British police are reportedly working from the theory that the nerve agent was somehow stowed in Yulia's luggage when she came to visit her father from Russia. Moscow has now also opened their own investigation into the attack on Yulia, who is a Russian citizen. They've also opened a parallel inquiry into the death of this Russian businessman, Nikolai Glushkov, who was found dead in his London home on Monday.
Reuters' Jacob Greaves. Russian President Vladimir Putin was in high spirits as he took the stage in Crimea, addressing an ultra-patriotic concert rally marking the fourth anniversary of the internationally unrecognized referendum intended to legitimize Russia's annexation of the Black Sea Peninsula. This is VOA News. The UN Special Envoy for Syria, Staffan de Mistura, says the violence in eastern Ghouta and Afrin could be avoided if all parties would honor the UN peace resolution.
It need not to be this way. Negotiations in Douma in the last few days do show that there is a way to create the conditions to advance the implementation of your resolution 2401.
Thousands have fled eastern Ghouta in recent days to escape the fighting. North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho and Swedish Prime Minister Stefan Löfven met briefly in Stockholm Friday, and Swedish UN Ambassador Olof Skog says it's to help build momentum for a broader agenda.
The security situation on the peninsula is one of the most pressing issues on the world agenda right now. And if Sweden can play a part in de-escalation there, this is what we're trying to do.
The talks in Stockholm continue Saturday after they were initially scheduled to end Friday. Through one of Australia's most successful Aboriginal mentoring projects called the Australia Indigenous Mentoring Experience, South African and Ugandan students will soon benefit from its methods. As Phil Mercer reports for VOA, university students give their time for free to teach and guide Indigenous high school pupils between the ages of 12 and 18. And the youngsters then, in turn, are given time to visit university campuses to attend workshops.
Indigenous groups say that education is the greatest single weapon to overcome disadvantage. But despite the concerted efforts of state and federal authorities, charities and other welfare groups, educational inequality persists. Disadvantage is entrenched, and while improvements in educational achievements are being made, many Indigenous students do poorly at school. About 60% of Aboriginal children are already well behind their non-Indigenous counterparts when they start school at the age of five. Australia's original inhabitants make up about 3% of the national population, but suffer disproportionately high rates of poverty, unemployment and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
President Trump has signed legislation encouraging the U.S. to send senior officials to Taiwan to meet their counterparts and vice versa, angering China, which views Taiwan as a wayward province. The White House says the bill, which is non-binding, would have gone into effect today even if Mr. Trump had not signed it. China's parliament unanimously re-elected President Xi Jinping to a second term Saturday with no limits on the number of terms he can serve. An amendment to scrap the two-term limit on the office of the president was approved last Sunday, along with 20 other changes. More at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
The abyss of supporters recognize that SLPP is the only option to knock out APC from power. So we have definitely made significant strides.
The Sierra Leonean main opposition party campaigns in the capital, Freetown, Saturday, ahead of the presidential election runoff.
Had the director of public prosecution arrived at a different determination, he would have been challenged bigger.
The South African state prosecutor reinstates corruption charges against former President Jacob Zuma.
The council of ministers meeting, as I said, depends on what the president, the instruction the president wants to give at the particular moment that he convenes that meeting.
And Cameroonian President Paul Biya holds first cabinet meeting since 2015. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The main opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP, is campaigning in the country's western area, which includes the capital Freetown, on Saturday for the March 27 presidential election runoff. The party's presidential candidate, former military ruler Brigadier Julius Maada Bio, faces former Foreign Minister Samora Wilson Kamara, who represents the ruling All People's Congress, or APC, in the runoff. Both candidates failed to garner the 55% to win the presidential election, a required threshold enshrined in the Sierra Leonean Constitution. For more about the opposition party's campaign, I reached Dr. Ali Kaba, campaign chairman for the opposition SLPP.
It is clear to everyone around the country that our campaign message is resonating everywhere. We have the best presidential candidate. Retired Brigadier Julius Maada Bio represents a new vision and a new direction, and that message is resonating across the country. And in the western area here, we have succeeded in finally dismantling the APC hegemony in this area because we won parliamentary seats in the general elections, and we are going in the runoff from a position of strength. We are leading. An opposition party that's been out of power for 10 years is actually leading the incumbent, a party that has been in power with absolute control over state resources. So we are confident that we will form the next government.
Your presidential candidate, as well as your team, have been meeting some other opposition candidates who were not fortunate to be able to make it to the runoff. How is that going, and how positive are you that they will support you ahead of the runoff?
Things are going very well. We have engaged all other opposition groups, and I must say that I'm excited about the possibility of all of us standing together now with one goal in mind, which is to knock out APC from power. And the conversations and engagement have clearly indicated that we are all in agreement. And as you all know, I mean, the situation right now is that there are only two parties contending during the runoff, SLPP and APC. So SLPP represents, you know, the most viable option for people today. And the opposition parties recognize that. Their supporters recognize that. So what we are getting at right now is having the leadership of the different groups standing together. And you're going to start to see that narrative emerging this coming week when opposition leaders of various parties will come out clearly in support of SLPP and our presidential candidate, the retired Brigadier Julius Maada Bio.
I understand the ruling APC stalwarts have approached C4C presidential candidate, former Vice President Sam Sumana, and other opposition parties seeking their endorsement for the runoff. How sure are you that you get the endorsement of the majority of the entire opposition presidential candidate to support your candidate, former military ruler Julius Maada Bio, in this runoff?
Well, as you speak, I can confidently tell you that we have the majority of the opposition groups willing to work with us. And I'm confident that the next few days we'll get to the point of having all of them, because they all recognize that the APC government over the last 10 years have recklessly destroyed this country. The economy is on life support. The democratic institutions have been completely decimated. There's deep poverty everywhere. youth unemployment stands at 80%. Educational system has collapsed. Healthcare system is completely dysfunctional. Their base of supporters recognize that SLPP is the only option to knock out APC from power. So we have definitely made significant strides, and I know for sure that those smaller parties will not want to be seen near, even 1,000 miles close to APC.
Issues of tribalism or ethnic-related voting have been raised in Sierra Leone. There is also this issue of violence even meted out against Electoral Commission officials that the Electoral Commission sharply condemned. What are your views? Some people are accusing SLPP supporters of being part of this negative or what they call attacks on their opponents. Your take?
Well, this is actually a fact, and that fact is that APC has embarked upon the dirty politics of tribal politics, in the sense that they have gone around the northern areas where we made significant inroads. You know, remember, they are acting out of desperation and fear now. We actually dismantled their hegemony in the north too. We won't sit in the north. So what we have demonstrated is that we are truly a national party. We appeal to the better angels in all of us. And that is why they are confused now. The only language they have now is going to those villages and telling the people that if you vote for SLPP, that's going to be the end of your existence here. So that message of fear is going to definitely drive more people towards us. SLPP, under the leadership of retired Brigadier Julius Madabi, has presented just that, a viable option. So we are not going to fall in that trap. We remain on the moral high ground. We want to lead this country in a new direction, make sure that we have inclusive governance, that development gets to every corner of the country, that a child in the Fadugu and the one in Kailaun should all have the same dreams, and they should have a ladder, a bridge to that future that will give them the opportunity to realize their dreams.
Dr. Ali Kaba is the campaign chairman for the Sierra Leonean main opposition party, SLPP. He spoke with me from Freetown. The South African state prosecutor Sean Abrahams has reinstated charges of corruption, fraud and racketeering against former President Jacob Zuma. The charges relate to a $2.5 billion arms deal in the 1990s when Zuma was the country's deputy president. Zuma has repeatedly denied the charges, while his supporters say the charges are politically motivated. Meanwhile, the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, welcomed the reinstatement of charges against the former president. For analysis, I reached Dr. Somadu Dafikeni, an independent policy and political analyst in the capital, Pretoria.
Well, I do think that this is a generally accepted move because all courts had made a clear indication that this ought to have been the case. If you want to sustain the rule of law, equality of every citizen before the law. And secondly, they are quick to remind people that initially, almost 9 years ago, President Zuma had said he wanted his day in court.
Dr. Fikeni, was the decision to reinstate these charges, in your view, a difficult one to make following the circumstances under which Zuma resigned amid these allegations of corruption against him all this while?
Well, I don't think it was a difficult one to make because courts had made their determination at all different levels of appeal. It was no longer an administrative or political matter now. It was in the hands of law enforcement and the judiciary. Had the director of public prosecution arrived at a different determination, he would have been challenged legally.
What do you say to critics who say that the decision to restore the charges indicate political interference, as his supporters are alleging?
Remember that this was tested in the courts of law and different levels of appeal up to the Supreme Court of Appeal. And all those indicated that there was no political interference that was of a nature that would have stopped or interfered with the process of charging President Zuma then.
The ANC, while President Zuma was in office, supported him that these charges against him were politically motivated. Today, they welcomed the decision to restore these charges against him. Why the about-face decision by the ANC leadership?
It is often easier and practical to make such a statement when the president is no longer there and he's no longer the leader of the party. because if he presides over meetings which have to pronounce on these matters, the political pressure of supporting the leader is always there.
Supporters of Zuma have questioned the loyalty of the new leadership of the ANC, particularly criticizing Cyril Ramaphosa for being behind the decision of the ANC to welcome the restoration of the charges against Jacob Zuma. Do you think their criticisms are justified?
I don't necessarily think so. It would just be a matter of delayed realization that this matter was no longer in the hands of any political role player because it had been thrown into the courts, it had been tested in the courts. They would seem to be supporting the rule of law by simply saying that they support this particular process. Had they said that they rejected the process, they would actually be opening themselves up to yet another political attack by opposition parties, especially so close to elections.
How soon do you expect Jacob Zuma to be in court?
Well, I do think that from now onwards, the process may move faster. It might be a matter of weeks rather than months before he appears before the courts. Because in the first instance, these charges have to be read out for him, and he has to assemble his legal team, and the process goes forward.
The government will not pay for his legal costs this time, will they?
At this particular moment, it is not quite clear, but it might be that some others, like the opposition parties, may challenge anything where government may start paying for his legal fees, where, one, he was not the president, and two, he was not doing this in his capacity as the president on behalf of government. It was rather a private matter with his friend.
Dr. Somado Dafikeni is a South African independent policy analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Some English-speaking Cameroonians have criticized President Paul Biya's government of failing to come up with solutions to resolve the ongoing crisis. Opponents also say the administration has failed to respond to calls by the country's development partners and the international community for dialogue with opponents without preconditions. The criticism came after President Biya held his first cabinet meeting since 2015 on Thursday. For reaction, I reached Dr. Elvis Ngolengule, coordinator of the Academia for the Ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, or CPDM, in the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
These criticisms are legitimate, given our Republican and democratic context. That is understandable, and I think that is normal. The second reaction I would like to make is that we shouldn't forget that a Council of Ministers meeting is a moment when the President of the Republic, in his constitutional prerogative as President of the Republic, invites ministers, both old and new ministers, during which he gives them instructions about certain political orientations and his expectations from a managerial standpoint as to what he expects of them as far as their performance is concerned. When the President does this, he does it according to his own political and managerial vision and political and managerial agenda.
Some Cameroonians are saying Thursday's meeting was the first the president has had since 2015 and that the country seemed to be running on autopilot. That is why the government, and for that matter the ruling CPDM party, has yet to come out with a cogent, pragmatic solution to resolve the ongoing crisis in the English-speaking part of the country. How do you react to such criticisms?
I think those criticisms, they ignore one thing. It is not only at a Council of Ministers meeting convened by the President that you solve all issues or the issues that some people hold dear to themselves. The Council of Ministers meeting, as I said, depends on what the President, the instruction the President wants to give at the particular moment that he convenes that meeting. Now, does that mean that the President has ignored the other issues like you are just alluding to? No. The President has been involved and has been trying to provide solutions in the last, since 2016, since the two Anglophone began to manifest these grievances.
Lots of solutions have been provided already. Administrative, political solutions have already been, lots of them have been provided. Some of them have been technical, particularly those concerning lawyers and those concerning teachers. The president has, for the first time in the history of this country, with the new government, created a new government ministry in charge of decentralization and local government. The president has also, in the new government, appointed for the first time in the history of Cameroon, two Anglophones in charge of two important ministries of sovereignty. One Anglophone in charge of the Ministry of Territorial Administration, another Anglophone in charge of the secondary education. Those are two ministries of sovereignty.
Dr. Angolé, I understand where you are coming from. However, there have been repeated calls by the international community and even Cameroonians to have a holistic dialogue between government or the ruling party and opponents in the country to resolve this Anglophone crisis. Even the Commonwealth made such efforts to broker a peace deal for a dialogue to happen. Why is there no political will? Why is this the problem and this is a stalemate now? Thousands of people are in jeopardy, are in the crosshairs of attacks and counterattacks from opponents and the government forces.
The answer is very simple, and I agree with you that lots of people and lots of important institutions in the world, some of which you have mentioned, have all called for dialogue. All Cameroonians want dialogue. Even the president wants dialogue. All I would like to tell you is that in Cameroon, dialogue takes many forms. Some forms are structured, others are not structured. From what I know, Cameroon has always opted for dialogue as one way of solving problems.
What is the end game here in resolving this Anglophone crisis?
The end game is simple. The end game is that Cameroon remains a one and indivisible nation in peace, in stability, in democracy. We don't need to go into the bushes. We don't need to kill each other. We don't need to cause violence on each other. I believe that all of us are thinking in the same direction to ensure that Cameroon remains one united and indivisible nation as our founding fathers had bequeathed to us. Now, how do we solve the problems? We don't solve the problems by killing each other or by ambushing or by burning or by preventing children from going to school. We solve the problem by being rational, by being sensitive to one another, and by meeting, trying to come to the center where we all meet and try to discuss our differences in a very amicable, fraternal, and harmonious manner.
Dr. Elvis Ngolé Ngolé is the coordinator of the Academia for the Cameroonian Ruling Party, the CPDM. He spoke with me from Yaoundé. A majority of Ugandans say wife beating is never justified, according to a new survey conducted by Afrobarometer. The latest study came a week after President Yoweri Museveni called for an end to domestic violence in his International Women's Day remarks, saying men who beat women are cowards. Meanwhile, a Ugandan parliamentarian sparked outrage after publicly stating that wife beating was acceptable. For more on the latest survey, I reach Francis Kibirige, the national coordinator of the Afrobarometer survey in Uganda and managing director of the Hachaya Consult Limited in the capital, Kampala.
The survey that we conducted at the start of last year does show that the majority of Ugandans are against wife beating and that it's never justified for a husband to beat his wife. And that particular attitude, that particular view is strongly high across all demographics. So it's a pretty strong view among its Ugandans. And a view that we feel should be translated into action. A view that, as you saw recently, when there was this unfortunate incident when one of our legislators did mention to the contrary, and there was an uproar across countries, especially among the elite, that such views don't have a place here. And we feel it's because of this strong background where you see that across urban, rural, across education profiles, across ages, and even across regions.
This survey came at a time when President Yoweri Museveni came out strongly against domestic violence. And then there was this issue of unsolved murders of Ugandan women in several parts of the country, and particularly in the capital, Kampala. Did this affect the survey?
The incident that you do mention did indeed happen later in the year. So we're talking about 2017. So we went to the field on Boxing Day in 2016 and finished field work in the first week of January. So the incidents of the unfortunate death of about 21 women who were young women who were murdered around the peripheries of the capital, in what are yet to be fully resolved by the police, and also the president's comments last week on International Women's Day did come well beyond the time of the survey.
What necessitated the survey in the first place?
Oh, the survey is a regular Afrobarometer survey that is conducted, part of the regular Afrobarometer surveys that are conducted across the entire continent every about 18 months. So this particular survey is a round 7 Afrobarometer survey, and it was conducted together with other surveys in now coming to over 30 countries in which that same survey was conducted and that same question was asked.
My question has to do with, was it because there is a prevalence of violence against women at home in Uganda, or there's a perception? What made the Afrobarometer and Hatchild Consult to zero in on this particular survey of domestic violence against women?
Good. Yeah, that's a very good question. So the Afrobarometer survey in general does focus on the quality of democracy and governance across the continent. And as part of the governance measure, we do focus on human rights and safeguards of human rights across the entire continent. And in this particular round, we also chose to poke into this particular issue of domestic violence. So it's different issues, different modules that get added to the survey or retired from the survey round in, round out. But for the case of Uganda, it wasn't particularly because of, say, a high incidence of domestic violence. Personally, I look at what has been happening in Uganda. I have been fortunate to work with the Afrobarometer survey in Uganda. So since the 90s, we've seen a very strong movement sweeping across the continent, and in particular in Uganda, of women emancipation and gender and gender issues and gender mainstreaming, and that has gained momentum. But over the last 10 or so years, there isn't been anything significant that has happened to say, wow, that's maybe the magic bullet that has made the difference. So I would say that yes. As a country, as a society, we still have problems with gender-based violence. But our inclusion of this particular question in the entire Afrobarometer module across all these countries, I don't think was particularly because there was a problem in Uganda per se.
Was there a general consensus on how best to resolve any possibility of gender-based violence in the homes in Uganda following your survey?
Well, there hasn't. Because, as you know, our survey is quite huge. So we pick out different aspects to disseminate. And in a survey that preceded a general election, you would imagine that the highest attention was paid to the political oriented questions in the survey. So for the case of gender-based violence and ways that this can be resolved, we haven't had a deeper discussion around that.
Francis Keberije is the National Coordinator of the Afrobarometer Survey in Uganda and Managing Director of Hatchild Consult Limited. He spoke with me from Kampala.
Shauna Renee, the lady DJ and host of Soul Lounge. Every Sunday at 1400 UTC, I choose an artist that you and I love, and we break down their entire career while listening to their biggest hits. That's what we do here on the Soul Lounge once again every Sunday, 1400 UTC, right here.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, this week, more than 8,500 Ethiopians crossed the border into Kenya seeking asylum from conflict after government troops mistakenly killed 9 civilians. The Red Cross said in a statement Wednesday that the number may keep increasing in the coming days. Ethiopia imposed a state of emergency following months of unrest in some parts of the country that tarnished the country's image as one of Africa's best performing economies. For more on the impact of the state of emergency, my colleague Douglas Impuga reached Yabese Boegia, a Seattle-based Ethiopian activist.
Well, right now, basically what we've gone through is seeing the impact of the state of emergency. I think before we even talk about the state of emergency, it's very important to know that there's still a lot of people like me who are watching the Egyptian politics forecast that the state of emergency is not going to stop the boycott. And that's why the free boycott is still going on while the state of emergency is going on. But one of the side effects of the state of emergency is the blanket right that's given to the army to basically take matters on his hand and start killing and shooting and things like that. Ever since it happened, in my own count, more than 27 people are recorded killed, including a 10-year-old boy and a 15-year-old boy. So basically what's going on right now is the impact of what we all are afraid of is happening.
How do you see this campaign going different from what you have been actively engaged in?
Well, basically, when a lot of problem in Ethiopia is people from outside kept on getting misinformed about what's going on in Ethiopia. People in Ethiopia know that the government is not doing releasing these people in good intention, because when they release them, they are not release them based on the merits of what they are going to do next. They release them because they are pressured by Kero, which is the young people who are protesting on the streets, almost paralyzing the country. Africans are really right now are awakened, and young people are asking their rights. That is a the problem with the government is not being trusted and given a solution to the problem. And even if the struggle seemed a little bit different, the base are the same. And for a long time, the Ethiopian government was basically suppressing people's voices. And I think finally it comes to erupt. And the dangerous part of this is other elements that we need to talk about, which is ethnic element of it. So we are keep on pushing people not to choose that route and to be their brothers and sisters keepers, even if the government is not.
To what extent is this a result of the resignation of the Prime Minister?
I think the resignation of the President, of the Prime Minister, even if it seemed like a big deal, for some of us watching the government, know that the Prime Minister to begin with is basically a Manchurian candidate who does not have a power to change most of the things in Ethiopia. And so, but I have to reemphasize the naming of the new Prime Minister might be a signal to move in the country. Even if we don't think that just because somebody's named, the things will change quickly, but it can show and signal a new move by the government. So it's very important, and I think I'm watching more what they're going to name rather than who left the position, because we believe that was aligned with our peace to begin with.
Do you see those in power in Addis Ababa somehow feeling the pinch of these protests, and do you think they are feeling the pressure, or they're just ignoring it?
Well, they definitely felt the pressure, but the problem is they keep on coming back to the same solution of trying to stop it by guns. I think what's sad about the whole situation is that the government got a chance to address the problem and They talked the talk, but they did not walk the walk. James Baldwin said, you know, I don't believe what you say because I see what you do. Most young people on the street knew that the government kept on saying, for example, the prime minister, the outgoing prime minister, made a speech saying, we're going to fix our problem. We are corrupted. We are looting the country. He said all of these things. And then the solution never came back. People who are still losing the country, Alan Powell, people who are actually accused of human rights violation, Alan Powell, people who are actually were killing people when they say they have a problem, were now back into power with the state of emergency. So even if they felt the problem, they actually not doing anything with it. And that's the saddest part of what's happening right now. And that's what kept me up at night, is because the people in the leadership are actually not understanding the gravity of the situation.
Yades Abojia is a Seattle-based Ethiopian activist. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Seattle, Washington. The decision by U.S. President Donald Trump to sack Secretary of State Rex Tillerson took many Africans by surprise. Tillerson was concluding his first African tour when he was dismissed by Trump. There have been various reactions in Africa since the announcement was made. Dr. Segun Bolarinwa is a senior research fellow and head of security and strategic studies at the Nigerian Institute of International Affairs, Lagos. For VOA, he told reporter Mike Mbonye that though the sack came as a shock to Africans, there will be continuity in American policies towards Africa.
To an extent, it does affect, but of course we know that government or the issue of governance is a continuum. In other words, soldier goes and soldier comes. So whether Tillerson is sacked and Pompeo comes in, it doesn't mean whatever agreements, whatever issues Tillerson must have discussed with Nigerian leaders in Africa, particularly that of Nigeria, I think still holds. And it happens more at the summit level, president to president, minister to minister, government to government. So it's at the summit level. So it really does not affect so much. But to an extent, Nigerian government, the only thing Nigerian government and some other African countries have expressed to Tillerson's sack is only that of shock. They were shocked because he was still on his trip. He hasn't returned to U.S. before he was sacked.
How do you view Tillerson's trip? It was said to be based on security and trade. Do you have any word on topics discussed with Nigerian officials?
Yes. I'm aware we were even part of people that observed the discussions. He discussed so much about security, discussed so much about the Lake Chad Basin, discussed so much about the Boko Haram insurgency, how far has Nigeria gone. Also, the U.S. government, through Tillerson, commended the Nigerian government because presently he said the Buhari government had taken the fight against the Boko Haram insurgency to a very high level. And the truth is that on ground, Boko Haram have been displaced. They have no unified front again. But of course, there will be some other elements around, suicide bombers, sudden attacks around the places. So Nigerian government needs, they should keep asking. They are ready to help. In the area of trade, you know, before the end of 2014, USB used to be the biggest buyer of Nigeria's crude oil. And before also the fall in the prices of oil at the international markets. And, you know, thereafter, everything fell. See, now it's been fluctuating between 40-something and 50-something. So he promised that the U.S. government will improve trade relations with Nigeria and they will still be buying more of our crude oil. But I'm not sure they'll be buying as they used to buy because they were the biggest buyer before now. But presently now, India is the biggest buyer of Nigeria's crude oil.
For those in Africa, especially Nigeria, who have been critical of Tillerson's handling of African policy, what are the main issues that African and Nigerian leaders would like to see the U.S. government address? What do analysts and African officials say they need from the U.S. government?
Well, every U.S. government, they always announce aid, they always announce help, support financially. In the case of Nigeria, in the case of most African governments presently now, what we need from the United States is support. Of course, when Tillerson came, he announced about $540-something million aid. Out of it, about $3-something to Nigeria. and the Lake Chad Basin in helping our security. So what we request is that they should always support us in the area of security. They should always support us in the area of trade. They should always support us, even politically, when we need any help.
What old partnerships need to be renewed? The Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, Feed the Future, Power Africa, Africa Leadership Initiative. How successful have these long-established programs been in Africa or Nigeria?
Let me start from behind. These programs, our partnership between Africa and U.S., like the AGOA, like the Power Africa, like the Africa Leadership. For example, under the Africa Leadership Initiative, I've enjoyed under it too, because I was taken by U.S. government and I was in U.S. for a few months, later a few years, a colleague of mine in my office too. And so I will want them particularly to resuscitate Africa Leadership Initiative, because it helps the youth, it helps the nation, it brings the future of Africa to our hands. In other words, putting it in our hands, and we now see the way it's going to be. So I want that of the partnership of Africa Leadership Initiative to be renewed, to be resuscitated, so that many youths and even some of us will still continue to benefit from it.
Dr. Segun Bolarinwa is a senior research fellow and head of security and strategic studies at the Nigerian Institute of International Affairs. For VOA, he spoke with reporter Mike Mbonyi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. Africa has been slower to adopt clean, renewable energy than many experts in the field had expected. In a bid to speed things up, TIDE, the Africa Enterprise Challenge Fund, has been helping entities operating renewable energy projects and powering rural communities. In Zimbabwe, the group is eager to develop new projects. For VOA reporter Kuzai Zvanavashi has details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Victor Ndiege with the Africa Enterprise Challenge Fund says the group is reaching millions of people in Africa with development projects, particularly in renewable energy.
So far as the ECF, we have benefited 13 million people across sub-Saharan Africa. We have financed 267 companies across sub-Saharan Africa. We have a total fund size of $310 million. As the renewable energy and climate technologies portfolio, we have benefited up to 4.5 million people across sub-Saharan Africa.
It took 5 years to bring renewable energy to that 4.5 million. But the fund aims to reach at least 10 million people in the next 3 years. The organization, which is based in Kenya, focuses on projects that push development. Ndiege says it provides financing and directs capital to companies that are willing to enter difficult markets, such as those with high costs or infrastructure difficulties. AECEF has been investing in agribusinesses in Zimbabwe, and now companies here welcome its interest in renewable energy. Isaiah Nyakusendwa is with the Renewable Energy Association of Zimbabwe.
The Zimbabwean Challenge has always been funding, and the market itself doesn't have appropriate funding which is necessary for renewable energy projects, because by their nature they take a long time to actually implement, and our banks also don't understand renewable energies because it's something that is relatively new to them.
Some Zimbabwean energy companies and microfinance companies have already received funding, a total of $2.6 million so far. Ndieke says his organization will unveil another competition for funding soon.
We think there's great potential, and from the 2.6 million, we are now saying, can we put in 6.5 million to see if that can help the market?
He adds that the fund intends to strengthen its presence in Zimbabwe, and he urged other stakeholders, such as the government, to support it. In other parts of sub-Saharan Africa, it has helped impoverished communities start renewable energy projects, often by lending funds so people can acquire solar systems for homes. Such initiatives give rural people a credit history as they pay off the loans,
and that makes them attractive to traditional banks. AECEF funding is often grants or zero-interest loans, but both come with stringent requirements. To get a grant, companies must show their plans benefit rural communities. And if a company can get all of its funding from traditional institutions, then it does not qualify for AECF help. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
And right now it's time for music from African Collection.
Salamu wangu mimi mwambia mesha kuwa nahitaji kukua kwanza we na mume utambe na uringe na mimi we na mke ili unichunge karo nuru yako kama mbala mwezi na uzuri wa macho yako kama na machozi peruke 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 mama
the shawty. Keep on shaking your bum, 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 bum. See, see, me all like to party. Party with the boys, we get money, yeah.
And that was Music from the Continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the crocodile does not die under the water, so that we can call the monkey to celebrate its funeral. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Nothing is more important to sub-Saharan Africa's future than inexpensive, reliable energy delivery. No endeavor can succeed without it. Indeed, said USAID Administrator Mark Green at the 4th annual Powering Africa Summit, power is also a crucial ingredient in our response to perhaps the greatest development challenge of our time, the displacement of families and communities around the world. That's because power and connectivity allow the displaced to stay in touch with family and friends and to order their lives before setting off for a new home. However, in sub-Saharan Africa, millions of displaced people are living indefinitely in camps with no power. This is where Power Africa comes in. In January, USAID announced a new partnership between Power Africa and MasterCard, aimed at helping to connect millions of displaced Africans to electricity, digital tools, and network internet connectivity. Through Power Africa, we help convene more than 20 partners, from MasterCard to Mercy Corps to Energy Peace Partners. Together, we're working to power and connect 5 different refugee camps, 3 in Uganda and 2 in Kenya, said USAID Administrator Green. Power Africa is a truly successful partnership between the government and the private sector. Power Africa works, said Administrator Green. It has helped 58 million people gain access to electricity using market forces and enterprise principles. It has turned to over 140 private sector partners and used the convening and policy-setting authorities that are the rightful role of government to help facilitate deals totaling $14.5 billion. That's the private sector side. On the government side, USAID is providing technical assistance and loan guarantees to facilitate investment. The Millennium Challenge Corporation is pursuing energy sector reforms. The State Department is working to help strengthen energy sector governance, while the Overseas Private Investment Corporation is investing in energy infrastructure across the continent. This should be Africa's time, said USAID Administrator Green. The continent of Africa boasts potential, enormous potential. Its resources, its farm and grazing land, but most importantly, the awe-inspiring spirit of resilience and joy that lives within so many of its people. As President Trump said last fall, on the margins of the UN General Assembly, when it comes to Africa, the outlook is bright.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.